All right, so while we wait for this to load, good morning, everyone. It's a pleasure to be speaking to you all today. I think mine is going to take a little bit of a different approach. I think the two presenters before me who delivered excellent presentations really focused on very specific topics. Mine is really going to talk a little bit more about health information technology in a very general and broad sense. My colleagues have come before me have stated, I have no personal financial relationships or commercial interest, at least not for the next 90 minutes. The focus of my presentation really is going to be divided along four principal parts, really to look at what defines the digital divide, and I think that is probably the most important. Having been the co-chair of the health information technology section this year, I have heard five presentations already on the digital divide, and I have not heard a similar definition for any of them. There are a variety of definitions to use, but before we go any further, it's crucial that we at least understand at a baseline what that definition means. To understand the question of access, which I think is extraordinarily important. Most people, when they look at a digital divide, think it's a question of accessing technology, which is then defined further as there is a computer that I can use. Access, especially when it comes to health, is far more than just the technology alone. Technology in isolation is actually one of the things that causes a digital divide. Then to use the effective use of HIT, which looks at all of the factors that surround how to close the chasm between those that have access to technology and those that do not, and then what the potential solutions may be. I'm going to start with this individual, and so here's a brief quiz. Anyone know who this is? Any philosophy majors out there besides me? Anyone want to admit that they're a philosophy major besides myself? It's John Stuart Mill. Excellent. Very good. So John Stuart Mill was the one that created or devised the theory of utilitarianism. And this is a quote from probably his most famous treatise on liberty, which says, as long as justice and injustice have not terminated their ever-renewing fight for ascendancy in the affairs of mankind, human beings must be willing, when need is, to do battle for one against the other. Why is that significant? When Mill came up with the idea of utilitarianism, he was redefining social theory. He was taking from his colleague, Jeremy Bentham, who said, if you do harm to yourself and no one else, that's fine. Society and government should not get involved. Mill took it a step further and said, if you do harm to yourself, it is impossible to not do harm to society. And therefore, somebody or something has to intervene to stop that harm. And what I would say to all of you, in this era of health information technology, which is getting so much attention and so much light, that if we do not look and examine as to what the digital divide is and possibly explore ways of closing that gap, then we are doing harm to society by not allowing individuals to access the technology to better their own health. What do we define the digital divide as? There's over 1 million entries on Google for this term, and I know all of you have PDAs. You don't need to look this up right now. You can look it up later. But there's 1 million definitions. The one that I like the best comes from the Office of Economic Cooperation and Development, which says it refers to the gap between individuals, households, businesses, and geographic areas at different socioeconomic levels with regard to their opportunities to access information and communication technologies and to their use of the internet for a wide variety of activities. Why do I like that definition as opposed to the other 1 million that are out there? Because I think it underscores two key components. It does not talk about technology alone, and it talks about all of the factors that influence technology, particularly the socioeconomic ones, which play a critical part in why there's a digital divide to begin with. The facets of the digital divide really are a confluence of factors. Yes, some of them are technical. There are individuals and communities and areas, rural areas in particular, that do not have access to the technology that most of us enjoy. But it goes beyond that. It is a linguistic issue. Are you able to comprehend the information that is being presented to you as a result of the technology? It is a literacy level. Do you understand? Can you comprehend? If I tell you that your glucose rate is above 280, do you know what that means? Or is it just an isolated number for you? The content, is the content specific to communities? Does it take into account every conceivable area of diversity that exists within many of these communities that are trying to harness the very technology that we use? And it is social. Are there reasons that people don't use technology? I always use this, I tell this story a variety of times, which is my parents are very aware of what I do for a living, and one would hope are proud of what I'm doing. And they are very aware of the kinds of technologies that are out there, but to this day, do not use online banking. They have to be the only two people on the planet that do not use online banking. And why is that? Because they simply do not trust the internet. Now, I could easily spend an hour talking to them about how safe it is, why it's not going to be intercepted, and even if it is, there are mechanisms to correct it, won't matter. They trust no one. That is a social reason as to why people don't use technology, and that of and in itself is a reason that is often ignored. Oops, sorry. Why is this so relevant in the area of health IT? Of the community health centers, which primarily serve poor and underserved populations, that have adopted an electronic health record, only 38% out of every community health center can use them to enter clinical notes, issue medication alerts or prompts, or even list medications that are used by a patient. The evidence, overwhelming evidence, suggests the quality of the online health information varies widely along several dimensions, including accuracy, completeness, consistency, and even more important, readability. Are you able to understand what is being presented to you? 18% of the American public speak a language other than English, and 45% have limited English proficiency. 49.7, almost 50 million Americans have a long-lasting physical impairment, often ignored. Sensory impairments are often not considered sometime in the design of technologies, including 9.3 million that have a sight or hearing impediment. So we start the discussion by looking at a question of access. And how is access defined? It is technical in terms of infrastructure, but it is also the effective use of the technology, and it is being able to consume the information that's being presented rather than simply producing and distributing. We can all type documents, we can all produce vast quantities of information, but how do we distribute it effectively in a way where we are allowed to consume it in a way that betters our own health and empowers us with the knowledge? When we engage with a provider, we have a firm ground of what we need to be discussing. Access is clearly fundamental. I would never say anything differently. It's basic to other developments and uses of health IT. It does involve the use of broadband. The era of dial-up, sorry to say, is rapidly diminishing, largely because the applications that we use on an everyday purpose are simply too large and too cumbersome to be used in a dial-up environment. But there has to be other high-throughput infrastructures that are efficient, that can process vast quantities of information in rural or remote areas where availability is limited. This summer, I had the opportunity to visit several community health centers in very rural, impoverished areas where access to this basic component of just being able to utilize the internet through broadband access was highly limited. So clearly, the first step in closing the divide is to be able to access it in a way that harnesses some of this technology or some of the availability of fiber optics or broadband. There has to be a support for a multiplicity of user roles that involve the creation of content, the dissemination of that content to the appropriate audiences, and the retrieval of very vital health information. To recognize the interplay of social and technical dimensions, again, not ignoring people's adversity to technology, and there are people that are out there, not just my parents. There are people who are even more adverse to discussing health information utilizing technology because of individual privacy or security concerns. To ignore those concerns or to downplay those concerns does not do anything to shore up the divide. In fact, I would say it actually makes it even further. It's not simply to look at the technical issues, it's the social aspects as well. Is there a social mechanism where we put people at ease or at least give them the understanding of knowing how the technology can be used, how it can better their health, how their privacy and security is maintained, and the different roles that can be played in this environment? The identification of access gaps. Without going on my high horse, and there are those in the audience that know me, that's a difficult thing to do. But clearly, health IT at the moment is very much a market-driven environment. The best example I can give, and I'll swear I'll spend 60 seconds on this, is the HIMSS conference, which is the largest health IT conference in North America. In fact, one would say the largest health IT conference in the world. 10 years ago, for those of us who actually went there 10 years ago, it was not nearly as big. It was an era where certainly vendors were showcasing their latest devices or latest goods, but 50% of that conference was really discussion of the future, how to operationalize the future, what technology could do in the future. Now if you go to HIMSS, it's 35,000 people. It's almost three times the size of this conference. The vendor displays are enormous, to say the least. And it's become so much more of a vendor-oriented conference that it clearly underscores why the market is driving this. If we are going to acknowledge that the market is driving health IT, what social segments then are left out and what need enhancements of public initiatives? Again, to go back to Mill's quote, if we're harming society by not granting this access, how do we utilize our society to shore up that very problem? Effective use is probably, in my mind at least, the most critical component of the digital divide. It's not simply accessing the technology, it is being able to use it in an effective way for healthcare. This involves carriage facilities, which is generally what everyone associates with the digital divide, having access to the technology. Input-output devices, tools and support, content services, service access and provisions, social facilitations, and governance. This almost constitutes what we would call an effective use rainbow, such as the carriage facilities. Is the technical infrastructure enough to support the application being used? Personal health records are certainly, as my co-presenter acknowledged, becoming far more significant now. To access a personal health record, you either need an iPhone, which has roughly 100 personal health applications, or you need access to a computer and a broadband line so that you can access that technology either through your health insurer or possibly through a private portal. But do you have the capacity in these environments to do that? Do these non-technical rural communities actually have the infrastructure to support that? It's fine to produce, but you have to be able to consume. And the only way to consume is to develop the infrastructure to support that. Are there output devices required for an application available? For example, it's wonderful if you have a medication management list that can go on your PDA. Fantastic. If nobody has a PDA in your community, what good is that doing? It's not doing any good. You're not allowing people to consume, you're just simply producing for the benefit of producing. Tools and support, what physical supports, protocols, and service supports are available? Are there people within the community that can help bridge this effective use of technology? Content services, which is something I harp on frequently. What specifically designed content is available for a particular area? Focusing on local contextual requirements, considering the diversity of the audience. Language, design, literacy level, cultural sensitivities, have all of those been addressed? Another issue about my parents, by my father in particular. So he's been running a help desk for about 10 years now. And every year, he gets the same question. People will call him up and say, I cannot find the any key. And he'll look and go, the any key. If those of you notice, when you're loading an application, it'll say, press any key to begin. And there are people that look and like, I can't find the any key. And so they call the help desk asking where this non-existent key is. Now we all laugh at that because we've done applications for years and we clearly know any key means any key. But think about that for a moment. In areas where literacy may be low, in areas where the application itself is not overly usable, that's a perfectly legitimate question. That it should have a design and function that helps people understand any key means any key. Some visual display, some understanding that you don't have to call the help desk to ask, you should be able to learn this on your own. Even as ridiculous as that may sound, it underscores the greater issue of usability, particularly in the context of health IT. Service action and provision. Effective use of e-health services in remote areas require a robust infrastructure of support and continuing design rather than waiting for somebody hundreds and thousands of miles away to develop updates. Is there an infrastructure and support network locally to help? And then including healthcare professionals, paraprofessionals, community support systems, etc. If you have a personal health record and you find in tracking your health condition that there's something you need to use a physician for, it would be helpful if there was a physician nearby, or a nurse practitioner, or somebody to help you as you access this information to be able to use it in a more effective way. What local resources, support, and training are available for the desired application? You cannot design and leave it in isolation. You have to design and then have the social network around to help facilitate the effective use of it. And then finally, what required financing, regulatory, or financing changes are needed to support an application? If it is something that is paramount to the environment, to our society, how then do you effectively use it? And what supports are necessary either locally or nationally or even statewide to help, again, facilitate that use? A way of looking at this in action is that the infrastructure is appropriate to the application being developed. Broadband or fiber optic services are there. The output devices, computers or PDAs, are available to everyone. Peripherals are required to support the application are available locally. So for example, if this is a computer-based application, there are computers in libraries or in boys and girls clubs or in schools. The content of the application described and presented in the language and literacy level appropriate to the end users. You do the research before you design. As a former programmer, which I do admit, you have to research the environment before you code. Service application is appropriate to the particular circumstances and end users. It is something the community wants. The application includes the provision for capacity development so that as the needs continue to grow, the application can evolve with it, and that there's financial stability and existing regulatory framework that allows the application to be sustainable over time, that it does not sunset over a period of time, that it can continue to be used. For example, a personal health record. There's widespread broadband Wi-Fi access available. A large majority of citizens in the community have a PC or PDA with access. There's access to PCs at the local library or health center or school. The application meets acceptable standards for usability, disability, and literacy. It's checked before it goes live. Medical facilities are within a reasonable distance, so if you need to see a physician, you have one. Physician, nurses, social workers, and other medical professionals are available, and that the appropriate privacy and security infrastructure is in place, and that there is funding to continually to enhance and update the application. If we want to bridge the divide, that's the process to follow. That is the only way to effectively close the chasm by examining the different aspects that caused the divide to begin with. So how do we move to a potential solution? How exactly do we move to enlightenment to help us in this situation, given that the problem has continued to be a problem for a long period of time? Participatory design is probably the best and most effective way. An approach most support of effective use is that when the community actually helps design the application or offers input into the content. An e-health application should be built in conjunction with providers, paraprofessionals, and individuals. The application would be built with local needs in mind and would create local champions and local ownership, and it would take into account cultural norms, literacy levels, access to the entire community, and other items. Who would be best to help design an application that's appropriate to a community other than the community itself? Now, I'm sure all of you are like, you're whacked. which is not the first time I've heard that. And people would say, how exactly do you participate in that? Most of these are vendors. You just said it's a market-driven economy. You just went off about hymns and how vendors are driving these products. How do we do participatory design in this environment when vendors are controlling it? There is a way, because not all vendors control the market. There is a potential method, at least, to help this, and that is the availability of what we would term as open source products. Now, open source has, for lack of a better term, a negative connotation. People hear the term open source, they think it's, you know, three of us in a basement hammering out some program that only three of us can actually understand. And that open source is inherently unreliable. It doesn't go through a strict vendor development lifecycle. It's not Microsoft, it's not Dell, it's not Apple. But let me ask a question. How many of you use Facebook? Who doesn't use Facebook is probably the better question, right? How many of you use Twitter? I'm glad that all of you are so interesting to be microblogging frequently. How many of you use LinkedIn? All right, we all use LinkedIn. Okay, guess what? They're all open source products. They all were designed on open source platforms. They are not commercially based at all. If you really look, for those of us that are really into computing, there have been numerous tests and publications indicating that really looking at the reliability of platforms to launch applications and sustain them, that there's certainly one platform that is more beneficial than another. You know what it is? Linux is actually a more reliable platform than Windows, and Linux, oh goodness, it's open source. Open source does not necessarily refer to something that is less than reliable. Open source actually encourages user and stakeholder participation. Modifications are made to the application through the collective interest, skill, and need of a community. Community of users can animate the acquisition and implementation based on the local need of interest, and it's a transparent process. All changes, modifications, adaptations, the entire community knows. In fact, and I'll end with this, that there's really only two electronic health record applications that have been known to be sustainable, that have been known to be reliable, and that have been used for almost three decades at this point and are fully interoperable. What are they? One is Vista, which is used by the Veterans Administration, and another one is the Resource Patient Management System, which is actually a Vista derivative that's used by the Indian Health Service, and guess what? They're both open source as well. If we can use open source in the federal space to help create this participatory design for veterans and for Native Americans, clearly we can use the open source environment for participatory design for communities that are unfortunately victimized by the digital divide and find a mechanism to close the gap. Thank you very much.
So now we're at my favorite part of the plenary, or the special session, which is the time for discussion. So we heard speakers from three different areas, and now we're going to take a crack at mixing all this together and figuring out what the public health community should focus on. So at this point, I'm going to start us off with a question, but then also if you have questions you'd like to have answered, please come up to the microphones as well. So the first question I have is one of practicality, which is, we as public health don't get to decide where all the funding goes. We don't get to decide where the market is going. We can influence it, but it is not just up to us. So these things are moving, they're moving fast, and there's a lot of money involved. Frequently, I think I'm comfortable saying, public health is behind the times when it comes to implementation. We're not frequently at the table for decision making. We're not always in the kind of visioning space for new technologies and new research and development. And that's not the best thing for us. We need to get out ahead of these issues. So my question for each of the speakers today is, where do we focus now? Where do we need to put our effort, whether it be policy, whether it be technology and funding, whether it be just kind of being at the table? Where do we have to be starting today to make sure that we reach this goal of better access and less disparities with the advancements in technology that we're talking about? And please speak into the microphone so it gets recorded.
me to start?
Sure. So, James, I guess I would answer the question by saying I think the best way, at least the most effective way, is to take the open source concept and expand it throughout our communities. And what I mean by that is, if we are really going to look at creating technologies or having technologies be accessed to communities that are behind the times, so to speak, or don't have the availability of those technologies, then we expand the open source network by having the government sponsor or help to support the very applications that they use within their environments that have been known to be effective not simply in just providing immediate patient care, but also in providing great public health. For example, we did see in a community health center in West Virginia that they had actually used a Freedom of Information Act request, got the actual program code for the resource patient management system, translated that into their own clinical environment, and actually was able to use it in a way to help monitor and effectively treat chronic conditions before they worsened to a point where they were becoming a burden in the very community. So they were using clinical reminders and decision support to help with diabetes treatment, with hypolipidemia, with hypertension, and with asthma. And that was not just affecting each individual, but that was affecting the public health as a whole. So if we allow the government then, which they can't do at the moment, but to be able to sponsor these technologies outside of their environment and make them at a baseline level accessible for these communities that can't afford the more vendor-driven technologies, and understand and train people on how they can be used for direct clinical care and for public health, then I think we help solve the problem.
Okay. And along those lines, what can the people in this room do to make that happen, I guess is part of this question. You know, yeah, what can the people in their, maybe in their own areas, and we don't know exactly who's in this room, but in different public health disciplines do to promote that?
Well, I mean, the quick answer is write your local senator, but in all seriousness, I think the thing to do really, there's probably two things to do, is probably get a much greater understanding of what these technologies can do, not just for individual care, but for public health. I think most people look at electronic health records or medical records as directly correlated to individual treatment, but they can be used for public health, and there is an effective way of doing so. And then to understand how your community could get involved in harnessing this technology, using this technology, in a way to create that participatory design where you're actually helping evolve the application from what your understanding of it is into something that's more designated for your particular community or your community's needs.
So I certainly would agree with all of that and say that I think while public health appears to be behind, it's probably ideally situated to be married very much with this idea of open source and commons and these kinds of concepts because it is about public health. And I think that I would take a long-tail approach to this answer and say that every individual in public health, wherever they are, and those are certainly really diverse communities and professions and industries, does adopt a sensibility that says we'll go into this without fear. Because what I've seen in the work that we're doing, either in public health labs for newborn screening or in public health contexts around infectious disease, et cetera, is a fear even between what should be very open communities and departments and states and whatever way you want to slice it, of being compared, because these open source technologies allow you to be compared. And I would say instead to go into that fear and say, of course we want to be compared, we want to understand better how one state differs from another, et cetera, so that we can garner the right dollars to move the right technologies to move the right kind of access and certainly ability to consume. So I think I would recommend also that certainly everybody write their senator. I think it's something that we, and on one hand that sounds flip and facetious, and we'd also include your representative as well. But I think we forget that the power of moving the administration is huge, and we've seen that over and over, and usually it's small groups of people with lots of money that get to do it, and instead if a whole community did it, it would be quite different. But also to look very, very locally and say, how can I move through the fear I have for becoming more open source and more interested in sharing information?
Well, the first thing that comes to my mind is that we need, as public health professionals, to understand the emerging technologies. And we focus a lot on policy and theory, but we need to know what's happening, what's coming out of the labs and research, so that we can promote ethical guidelines as to how to use these new disparities. And I see another major role for public health being advocacy. And when we see new technology that would really be helpful to large numbers of people, we have a responsibility to advocate for that technology. And I won't get into the who owns what part of it, but just the technology itself. And the other thing that comes to my mind immediately is training. We need to train our people, our public health people, in the issues of emerging technologies. For instance, I'm asking a Twitter expert to come to our next faculty meeting to talk to us about Twitter, because I don't understand what Twitter does. So we need to advocate for training for public health professionals and for all health professionals. That's part of our job as public health professionals.
Just want to add that we have known for a long time, and these issues have been studied and described. We have known that one of the major issues why the healthcare market does not work as a perfect market is that there is imbalance or asymmetry of the information between the providers and the users. So by disclosing information, by making it transparent, by allowing the public to have input and utilize it, that's one of the first steps in having greater access to healthcare technology. And the other one is health being considered a public good and not a private good, and that refers to relates to also regulation, and we know that the FDA is undergoing some changes regarding more strict regulation for some devices, and on the other hand, some deregulation of devices that have shown to be more effective.
Any questions from the audience at this point? Okay, over here.
I think that one of the reasons, at least in my mind, what could be a ray of hope so, is to really bring down the level, not bring down, but I think bring the level of discussion to something that's more comprehensible and can be demonstrated. I think when you talk about the types of access restriction technologies and encryptions that are used today to protect information that are extraordinarily strong, only those of us that are really well steeped in the technology can truly understand, a 256-bit encryption algorithm. But if I actually spend some time explaining that to non-technical people about why that protects your information, how that makes it far less likely to be intercepted, and then what can be done about it in case there is an issue, I think that that's where the discussion needs to turn. It needs to be less technical and more focused on how it protects the individual's needs, how the individual rights are preserved, and how access is granted and maintained in the course of a clinical encounter or the pulling of information from a clinical record into a personal health record, or even exchange between providers.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And what we've seen, and certainly this conversation happens everywhere that we're attempting our various tools, is that there is an activism that's coming from a limited number of individuals, really, that begins because, again, the media is very interested in sort of the sensationalism that begins to fuel, in fact, even activity that could be seen as quite negative. So, for example, the state of Texas destroyed all 5 million of their residual dry blood spots because 4 families sued that the privacy of their newborns and at that point children was not being protected. I don't think all the parents in the state of Texas understood what that meant. The burden to the public health laboratory was enormous for them to spend their resources on destroying their blood spots instead of on technology that in fact exists to protect the information and for people to opt in and out of the systems. So I think what I completely agree that we really need to look at how can we educate the public better and make it more whole, is technology more accessible. And at the same time, I also see a generational shift happening in which young people, my 2 children who are 21 and 23, have much less concern about privacy because they believe there is no privacy, that when they apply for a job, a lot is known about them because they've used Facebook for 5 years. I think that's true, and I think we're seeing some shift, but certainly while the gray hairs and white hairs run the policymaking positions, we will still see some high interest in privacy protection.
I think the organization of those impacted is a key issue here. If you look at some diseases such as hemophilia, the people own the data, and they have really used the technologies much more effectively than, for instance, the sickle cell community, who do not own the data. So I think that's an issue of getting people involved from the beginning on in the information and not letting the information be seen as government information. Keith.
Okay, another question over here.
I'm Steve from Montel University of Michigan. I'd like to use direct-to-consumer genetic testing as a way to work together in various areas. Originally, this sort of thing was out of my area of genetics through billfolds. But now, pardon me, there are various companies, and they're on the internet. And one can order a series of tests, nutrigenomics, ancestry testing, tests for rare Mendelian conditions, as well as complex conditions. I was pretty to see a slide of reports going back to consumers for 20 conditions. And the paragraphs were highly technical. They were very difficult to interpret. And those that were readable, they were not personalized. So does this last deficit, in your opinion, mean that the resource direct consumer genetic testing should therefore not be offered through this publicly available means on the internet?
I personally would say no. In fact, direct-to-consumer genetic testing is actually moving both the diagnostic market and the consumer interest in health in a great way. And certainly, it's disruptive and bumpy on the way. I'd also say that I think we spend a lot of time, especially in the genetics community, and when direct-to-consumer genetic testing first came out, the professional society spent a lot of time creating statements and putting together their concerns, when the last estimate for something like 23andMe was that 30,000 people in the U.S. have accessed it. So again, I would go back to, is that where we want to put our resources as a community on policy? There are some really tremendously wonderful examples of direct-to-consumer genetic testing, and I think we always compare all of these things and their apples and oranges and bananas, and we haven't really understood yet that some, in fact, employ genetics health professionals. Some do a great job with literacy and communications. Some do a terrible job, and you know, should eventually, when people will vote with their feet and will go out of business, when nobody will buy these tests because they're too expensive.
Any other thoughts?
Yes, I don't think we should ever restrict knowledge, but giving knowledge that is misunderstood can be very dangerous. And I think, I'll go back to sickle cell again. Sickle Cell Disease Association has a strategy where they put on their website the name and number of a nurse practitioner who could answer questions that you have about the disease. And I think it's very important as we make knowledge available that we also make the popularization of the information available.
To follow up that question, something that Jason mentioned is access alone doesn't reduce disparities. We're talking about with many of these technologies, whether they be medical technologies, whether they be internet technologies, more information. But more information isn't always better. So when we're talking about health care disparities, how do we balance this more information with the right information to focus on this problem as a community?
I guess the only follow-up I would have to that very briefly is if you really look at the rise and ascendancy of Apple, you know, people are just gaga. Oh, I mean, you know, you could come up with a cardboard box, put the Apple symbol on it, sell it for $100, and everybody would buy it. You know, people look at that like it's wicked cool, everybody's got one, it does all these wonderful things. But there's a real reason why Apple is so popular and why it got back into the market, and that is because it is an incredibly usable application. I mean, anyone can use an Apple product. I mean, my 7-year-old has mastered the iPhone, which is frightening in itself, but nonetheless was able to take that application and use it and comprehend what knowledge he was gaining from the applications that she